Beware your constituents. The friendlier they are, the more cautious you should be. The Master. Winter was ending. The government of Ulwing Grimaldi ground on. That talented, exotic and untrustworthy man had scored a few early big hits. Relations with Edinburgh had calmed down. Almost everything had been devolved. Grimaldi now agreed to devolve the post office and the weather. His greatest victory had been the transformational security deal with the Middle Eastern Caliphate. In late 2018, Caliph Abdulmesid III had been welcomed to London. Almost all the old countries of the European Union had by now banned the veil and imposed a moratorium on the building of new mosques. Grimaldi saw his opportunity. The bones of the Westminster Concordat promised that there would be no British interference in the affairs of the Caliphate and guaranteed freedom of worship for Muslims in Britain. In return, the Caliph had signed a wide-ranging security pact. Since his religious police were now working with the British security services, there had not been a single further attack. From now on, disaffected young Wahhabis and Deobandis from Birmingham or Cardiff were simply encouraged to return to former Iraq or Syria and do good works rebuilding shattered cities, offering aid to the displaced and protecting the new rulers. There had been outrage on the right of politics and among some disillusioned mullahs, but the overwhelming reaction from British voters was one of relief. Grimaldi, who until then had been regarded as a likable but ineffectual creature, found himself popular. He seemed to have put on 2 inches in height. He carried himself differently. The cartoonists, who had focused on his nose and compared him to Pinocchio, laid off a little bit. In the Commons, where his wafer-thin majority depended upon a couple of flaky, borderline certifiable backbenchers, he began to exude something like authority. The newspapers, with Quint and Rawnsley to the fore, revised their assumption that his government would last no longer than a few months. And yet, in his moment of triumph, Grimaldi had made some lethal enemies. Washington was livid. The president included Great Britain in his axis of appeasement. Closer to home, the master and his cronies, some of whom had been prepared to give Grimaldi the benefit of their many doubts, now saw him as a traitor and, worse, popular with it. The plan remained unchanged. The master, however, intimated that Grimaldi had to be terminated sooner rather than later. Peter Quint's paper obediently ran a big investigation into the sources of funding for the large new mosques that were being built along the British coast from Southwold to Aberdeen. Saudi money had dried up, dampening the London property boom of the early years of the century. But now, new gentlemen, bearded and wearing flowering white robes, arrived by plane from Damascus and Aleppo with huge wealth at their fingertips. Pure the Caliph himself might be, but the Caliphate contained as many traders and middlemen as before. Not all the new Muslim money went into the restoration of the sacred sites. Quite a bit of it purchased country houses around Sunningdale, or went to the direction and beautification of mosques. In one of his most pungent columns, Peter Quint asked what had happened to Britain's money laundering regulations and to the planning system, which seemed oddly relaxed where the mosques were concerned. He revealed that Ulwing Grimaldi's sister was working for a Middle East construction company, and that several key cabinet ministers were living a lifestyle which appeared to be incompatible with their salaries. All of this information, some of which was true, had come via Ella. Ulwing Grimaldi's reputation took its first serious knock. None of this would have mattered very much, except that something strange seemed to have happened to British politics. Westminster was completely losing its grip on the country's imagination. The newspapers might praise, then chastise the government, but who read the newspapers? The websites and the generations that feed on them were interested only in entertainment and celebrity murders. After the intellectual man of ideas, Ed Miliband, and his irate nemesis Michael Gove, hardly any politicians were recognised by the general public at all. It began to look as if the entire democratic system was nothing more than a conjurer's trick. It depended on the public paying attention, and as soon as they stopped, the colourfully painted pieces of pasteboard lay inert and useless on the table. The Grimaldi government spoke and was not heard. Schools got on with teaching extreme religious views or nothing very much at all, just as they liked. The failing privatised rail companies were now failing in public ownership. The collapse of part of the National Health Service had meant a return to private doctors charging what they could get away with. The cheapest and most popular ran their clinics as wholly owned subsidiaries of pharmaceutical companies. Relentlessly, year by year, the number of people who bothered to vote continued to decline. Alwyn Grimaldi, who understood that elective power was in a final and desperate struggle to survive against the power of the market, did not merely sit back and do nothing. He struggled to repeat the success of the Westminster Concordat. National work centres were established to provide compulsory literacy training. The Mayor of London, Lady Penny, had been allowed to establish a new free-floating currency to be used inside the M25 only, and the so-called red penny was now worth almost as much as a regular pound sterling. But the government found itself virtually ignored by what remained of the printed media and by television and internet bulletins. There is something worse in politics than abuse. The Labour government of Alwyn Grimaldi found itself boasting to a nation of turned backs. As Caro enjoyed the early spring sunshine in Regent's Park, it didn't seem to her that all was lost. Peter Quint's attacks on her in the press may have been an irritation, but Caroline was a buoyant girl. She was a cork. There was life and growth and hope. She passed the rose beds. "Remember me. Peace. Perception," she read as she walked. Hardly any of the rose blooms were visible yet, just an occasional splash of yellow or deep blood red. But the very names seemed colourful and promising. "Remember me, who I was. Perception. Light trails of scent." Caro thought, "I am changing. This is a time of change for me." Sheila's perfume, Deep Secret, Thinking of You, Octavia Hill. On she walked. Queen Mary's Gardens, Regent's Park, had been the last words the cultured, neatly painted and silk-scarfed woman had said the day before in the central lobby of the House of Commons. Before their meeting, going on what she picked up from the local newspaper, which described Leila Umar as outspoken, Caro had expected to be confronted by an angry-looking woman in a burqa. Or was it a niqab? She could never remember the difference, but this particular constituent, a dentist from the outlying part of Barker known as Springtown, a tough and down-at-heel suburb, despite its name, confounded Caro's expectations. Mrs. Umar was dressed in an M&S suit and appeared poised and relaxed among the passing MPs and journalists, half amused and, from the very first, eloquent. Leila Umar was observant enough to notice the new MP's surprise. "Not your average packy," she teased Caro. "You all need to do a lot of rethinking about our community, Mrs. Phillips. I know your Mother of Parliament very well indeed. We are not all village girls. But I want to talk to you properly, not just as my Member of Parliament, but as, I hope, a friend. So let's meet somewhere quieter and easier tomorrow. At last, spring is coming." And Leila had suggested this fragrant leaf-green oasis with its beds of roses just to the north of the choked, honking chaos of the Marylebone Road. There was a flash of sun, a flush, a fleshy warmth here. And there was colour. Not just the apple of the grass and the emerald of the newly budding trees, but the turquoise and scarlet of saris, and the golden black of an Arab woman in a chador with an elaborately patterned scarf. Kara reflected on the apparent distaste shown by the English for their own public parks. Here there were Chinese and Indian families, Japanese tourists, and French voices. But the only white English flesh was that of the occasional passing runner. She found herself wondering if the British, as they grew ever more slovenly and frantic, had lost the habit of simply standing back, sniffing the air and enjoying the moment. She felt she had a talent for the big questions. Tart Angela had said, "Less so for the big answers, dear." Or was it simply that in London there was little time for sniffing the roses and noting the changing seasons? This was a frantic city, no longer really part of England, where everyone seemed skittering and scurrying, clawing themselves up invisible walls, teetering on wobbly ladders, buffeted by the high winds of ridiculous ambition. The wind was cold, and she hugged her coat tightly to herself. Silly place to meet after all at this time of year. Not even a coffee shop anywhere about. Kara was about to leave when she saw Mrs. Umar waving at her from a bench. She seemed very small by comparison with the two green-uniformed gardeners who were noisily spreading muck on a rose bed from the back of a trailer, and who might regard her with contempt. Just my imagination, probably, Kara thought. But she felt herself warming to Leila Umar nonetheless. Leila stood, and they shook hands rather formally, then walked together towards the ornate little bridge across a small pond. "You did not expect to be approached by our community so early?" "I'm in Parliament to help everybody in the constituency, of course." "Yes, of course you are. And of course I'm here for help. But also to speak to you as a friend who knows the town of Barker very well. All my life I have lived in Springtown. My papa came over from Pakistan in the 1960s. My husband is also from Barker. He is an electrician, and by the grace of Allah the Merciful the Wise, a good man, a kind man." "I'm glad to hear it. Why did you think I wouldn't expect to be approached by constituents who happen to be Muslim, though?" "Ah, I thought that, like most of your people, you would be bigoted and against us." "Well, I'm not. But to be candid, Mrs. Umar, I'd been worried that I wouldn't be very popular with you. There were a group of Muslims in the audience on the evening of my selection as candidate who, if you remember, made much of my private life. Many people are old-fashioned. Even I, perhaps, am a little old-fashioned, Mrs. Phillips. And, by the way, may I ask, where does the Mrs. come from?" Caroline had long expected the question, though not today. "Well, I'm married, and I feel more comfortable with it. It's just my choice." "Everything is your choice, sister. That is England. But Muslims are particularly harsh on gay people." "Ah, little sister." Though surely Mrs. Umar, with her wrinkle-free skin, huge dark eyes, and soft hair tumbling out from below her scarf, was younger than Caroline. "All people of religion everywhere in the world believe in limits of that kind. The notable Quran is modest and restrained on these subjects. As compared, for instance, to your own Bible. I have read that you are a Christian." Caroline stiffened. She wanted this conversation to be over. "Mine is a God of love, not of prohibitions." Mrs. Umar stopped, tightened her green and yellow scarf, and then declaimed like a Victorian actress, waving her gloved hand under Caroline's nose. "Let those who find not the wherewithal for marriage keep themselves chaste until Allah gives them means out of his grace. That's chaste not chaste, sister. The Noble Quran, 24:33, I think you'll find. It sounds reasonable to me. Good Muslims have never had to deal with the dirty-minded prying and prohibiting of your own St. Paul. Very well, Mrs. Umar. I am who I am, and whatever our differences, I'm of course at your service. I want to be the Member of Parliament for everybody in Barker, irrespective of their personal views. That is indeed very liberal of you. What a liberal country this is, said Mrs. Umar dryly. My thanks. Shall we turn to the matter in hand? Ahead on the path, a dishevelled man was running towards them. He didn't look like a runner kind of runner. He was wearing jeans and a thick jersey. Instinctively, Caroline drew to one side to let him pass. But as he did, he turned and spat at Mrs. Umar. A long yellow stream of frothy gob landed on her sleeve. Caroline was briefly paralysed with shock. The man took a few further steps, then turned and spat again. This time he hit Mrs. Umar's face. The spit dribbled down her cheek. She looked back at him, expressionless. He turned and ran on. Caroline half shouted at him, then stopped and automatically reached up to brush her constituent's face. But Layla flinched away and used her scarf to clean herself.
Well, that was well-timed.
I'm terribly sorry. How horrible for you. I should have done something. I didn't know.
That's all right. What could you have done? Brute. But at least now you see. For us, in this liberal country, this kind of thing happens all the time.
You never know who will be next, where will be next. Now, we, the community, that is, followed the election campaign, of course. We noticed that defending women's rights was something you talked about, rather a lot. You gave that interview to the Mail. So, we have discussed this, and we have decided to trust you with our most precious plan and hope.
Can I be clear, Caroline asked, about just who the community are?
My dear, nothing sinister, I assure you. We are simply the ordinary mainstream Muslim people of Springtown. No terrorists, no extremists, just hard-working British shopkeepers and tradespeople, mothers and grannies and children, all looking to you.
You are very eloquent, Mrs. Umar. What exactly do you want me to do?
Mrs. Umar walked in silence for a moment or two before replying.
The Jews. The Jews have it. In North London, Hendon, Golders Green, up that way. An Eruf, they call it.
Yes, Caroline vaguely remembered something about Hasidic Jews and the erection of poles and wires.
Well, in Barker, we want much the same thing. If it's good enough for the Jews, it's good enough for law-abiding Muslims. We want an area, not a very big area, just a few streets in each direction around the mosque, where we will be allowed to live in peace under God's laws.
You want a special Sharia area?
In the middle of my constituency. Exactly. Where our women don't have to be frightened because they are dressed modestly. Where our men, Mrs. Phillips, don't have semi-naked flesh rubbed in their noses and the stink of alcohol from shops and pubs. We have our own ways of dealing with people who misbehave and flout God's law. We just want to be left alone to govern ourselves in peace, modesty and peace, without extremists marching through our streets. We cause nobody any harm. And if the government is worried about hot-headed young boys taking up violent jihad, then frankly, their best bet is to help us reinforce the authority of our own elders and our mullah.
This was not what Kara had expected when she'd taken the short taxi ride to Regent's Park. She could see the dangers. There was already a campaign in Barker and the neighbouring towns against the building of a third and larger mosque. Supporting Mrs. Umar's proposal wouldn't make her popular with her white constituents. On the other hand, she'd just seen for herself the kind of abuse Muslim women had to put up with. And if something similar had been allowed for the Jews of North London, what really was the case against giving it to Muslims in the Midlands? She needed time to think.
I need time to think. So, you're not turning us down flat. This is good news. I told them before I came down here that you were a good woman. You see, you are not all the same. That's what I said.
At that moment, a figure in full black burqa waved at them across the pond and whooped in a broad Barker accent.
Hey, Layla! That's you, sweetheart!
Oh, my goodness, Mrs. Phillips, there's Fatima. What a coincidence. She lives just round the corner from me. She's studying international diplomacy at London University.
Fatima bustled over. The two Barker women exchanged kisses and hugs, and Mrs. Umar introduced Caro.
An MP? Well, we are moving in posh circles. Take a photo. Yes, of course. You don't mind, do you, Mrs. Phillips? And then perhaps one of the three of us, all girls together?
And so, as Caro and Mrs. Umar grinned bravely in the cold, the picture was taken on Fatima's mobile phone by a helpful passerby. Fatima was smiling too, a smile of contempt, but you couldn't see that under her burqa. Once Caro had left, Mrs. Umar met the runner around the back of a rhododendron bush, thanked him.
That was well done,
and handed him a slim envelope. David Petrie M.